This meeting is now being recorded.
Okay, great. Thank you. This is Ram Mohan, and this is the Technical Study Group on Access to Non-Public Data. Today is the 29th of January, and we're back again to chat about the work that we're doing. I thought that today it might be useful to spend our time on the following items. First, review the unified requirements document that Andy and Scott put together, and then the second would be perhaps to look at the specification format and figure out what we want to do there. Although I think the specification format, what I'd like to do is I'd like to have people only make criticisms or you know, saying I agree or whatever, rather than have a full-scale discussion on it, so we conserve time. And then perhaps we spend just a little bit of time. I'm starting to get a little worried about our ability to meet the timeline and the milestones that we've set, so it would be good to go through that. And then, you know, I don't know if there's any other items that we should be covering. Folks, what do you think? Should we be covering anything else? Looking at Adobe, I don't see any hands raised. Oh, there is Andy.
Yes, thanks, Ram. I do have a couple of issues, a couple of things I would like to discuss. And I'll discuss them real quick. One is about a presentation to the IETF Regex Working Group about what we're doing. And then another one really, and that can be a quick conversation, but the other one is really about the output of the working group, the output of this group, sorry, and what we want to do. And I had a discussion with when Scott and I got together this past week. We had a discussion about going through and coming up with a complete and formal technical specification only to find out it doesn't meet the requirements that that can be set forth. And so it was really a discussion about how far we want to go before we actually get feedback about whether we're doing something incorrectly or correctly.
So I think it's kind of an thanks for that, Andy. So let's actually cover both of these right away. And there's also a request that went into Benedict to make a presentation into the NCSG at the ICANN meeting in Kobe. So I think in general, I think we do need to be able to present the output of our work and have you folks being able to go and make those presentations. I don't see any downside with that. And maybe all we need to do is to agree on, you know, get a template of what we want to say and what we want to present, and then each one of you who has a particular group who's asking for or where you think it's worthwhile presenting just goes and presents to that core template that we agree upon. Not template, but that core, you know, slide deck or whatever we agree upon. If that works for you, Andy, and for you, Benedict, then we can get the ICANN staff to start putting together, you know, a base based on what we've agreed so far, and we'll make sure that it's not process heavy and it's, you know, it's focused on why we're there, what we're doing, what we've done so far, where we expect this to go. I'm thinking should be the primary structure. Does that work for you, Andy?
Yes, I am. That works. The thing I'm trying to mitigate is generally that when people bring documents to the IETF after having gone and discussed them in private, the IETF gets a little out of sorts over that type of thing. And understandably, I've been in that position where I've disagreed with things like that. And so I just think as long as we're up front with them, I don't know if we're going to put documents into the IETF, but just letting them make, you know, be aware of what we're doing is, I think, a good thing.
Makes sense to me. And I see no reason not to share this widely. I mean, our intent is to actually get this used. otherwise we're kind of, you know, spinning our wheels.
Yeah. Agreed.
Okay. Benedict corrects me that it was not just NCSG, it was NCSG plus the Public Safety Working Group, which represents law enforcement. That's where the request has come in. I'm sure that at Kobe we'll end up presenting to multiple places. I would not be surprised if the contracted parties house wants to have an update, et cetera, as well. So, and I think in general we ought to be willing and able and wanting to go and present and speak with as many folks as possible, pull all the input in before we meet face to face there on Wednesday and get that moving. The second thing you asked about, Andy, had to do with how far should our spec go. I have a point of view on this, but I'd really like to get your perspective on it. My point of view is that we ought to make this a fairly well-defined, decent level of quality specification. And I think we should recognize that it may not be what's eventually adopted or used, but I see two or three positives to going that way. One is that it sets the model for what any final eventual specification ought to be. It sets at least what some of those base items should be, etc. Number one. Number two is that potentially, even if the final result ends up being a change from what we thought of, hopefully it'll be incremental rather than something dramatically different. So the work that we do might be able to inform the groups that are going to go and work on implementation very easily. The third thing is that we actually we are spending time. We've been put together. There is time, effort, money being spent on it. And I think we really have a responsibility to build out as good a spec as we can, rather than stop halfway because we are uncertain as to what the final implementation is going to be or what the final policy decisions are going to be. My perspective is we work with what we know and we build the best we can with what we know, and we build it out as technically solid as possible. That's where that's my kind of base design thought on this. I'd love to hear other points of view.
All right. Well, since I started this, and I have no problem with going in and doing a technical specification. The only reason I bring this up is because if we present a technical specification to policy people, they may not understand some of the things we're talking about, such as we say, well, there's a Java web token or JSON web token that contains these types of
right.
properties and whatnot. They'll you know, hey, that's fine, but what does it do? I think what they really want is a description of what it is we're trying to put together and the requirements we're trying to meet. And I think that's what they would appreciate. At least that's my opinion. So I'll shut up now and let other people talk.
What do others think? Scott?
Scott Hollenbeck here. Yeah, so to Andy's point, I mean, if you think of what we're doing as, you know, a design document of some sort, I think we have to remember that, you know, in software engineering, design is typically something that happens after definition of requirements.
Yes.
And, and it goes back to some of the questions I've been asking on list and in the meetings. It's like, you know, is this particular thing that we're talking about a requirement or a suggestion? And so I this came up in the conversation Andy and I had last week as we were looking at these, these required functions, and we realized, well, it's kind of hard to describe required functions, you know, or as part of a design without having agreement and documentation for what this thing that we're designing is, and where these, you know, so-called required features are coming from.
Right.
So, to Andy's point, it might be worthwhile. And look, I realize the charter that we agreed on attempts, you know, to set, you know, some type of a foundation to ground our conversations. But at a minimum, whatever we produce should have a fairly lengthy, you know, introduction or background section that helps lays out some of these, you know, foundational topics on which we're building.
I agree. I think that makes a lot of sense. What do others think?
This is Murray. That sounds excellent to me.
Anybody who dissents? John?
No, I'm not going to dissent. I agree, and that was one of Andy's comments in the email thread, is that we need something that's more descriptive as well. You know, although we're looking at the technical elements, we do have to be aware that a majority of the audience are not as technical as some of us are. So I agree, having a good, more human readable format would be good alongside the tech spec.
Okay. All right. I'm hoping we've got rid of the, not rid, but we've addressed these are important issues. They're also a little bit on the, you know, definition of what we do. Did we want to bring up the unified requirements document and go through that now, guys? Any objection to that?
Sounds like a good plan.
All right, Scott's typing in Adobe. Yeah, I'm glad that Andy volunteered you, Scott.
Yeah, he's good at that.
Long experience. Okay.
No objection from here. Just before we crack on, Ron, sorry to trouble you. I would just to let staff know that Gavin's been trying to join. I just wonder if he's in yet.
I don't see Gavin on the Adobe list. I'm surprised that he's having trouble. Yvette, can you reach out to Gavin and see if you can help loop him in?
Sure. I'll go ahead and do that right now.
I appreciate it. Thanks. Andy and Scott, do you want to walk through this and we'll, you know, go through a, you know, we'll just use Adobe to have Q&A.
Andy, go ahead.
Okay. All right. So Scott and I met sometime last week. We basically took the three set of requirements documents that we had and decided that what we wanted to do to the best of our ability was to take them as is and plug them into this. We weren't able to do that with everything, but I think we faithfully got all the requirements. As we were doing that, we were like, we keep saying the system must do this, but what part of the system? So we decided to break it down into four different components as to where these requirements fall. Meaning that we think this requirement is talking about this part of the system, and this other requirement is talking about this other part of the system. And of course, there are some things that are overall, and so we have a small overall section. I think it's five. I think the Adobe thing's not showing the fifth one.
You can now scroll page. Control has been released, Andy, so everybody can scroll the document themselves.
Okay, yeah. So it's six. How did I stop doing that? All right. Seven. So, you know, the areas that we came up with other than overall was, the browser-based portal that we believe ICANN would be running, what the identity providers would be doing, ICANN's actual RDAP proxy, the RDAP servers that run by the CPHs, and then we kind of broke out logging and auditing as a separate set of, requirements. And then the last one was performance and SLA, which may be something that goes up at the top. That was kind of one of the tough ones because we're not sure. First of all, we're not sure what these SLAs would be, and we're and that there may be different SLAs on different parts of the parties to the system. So so that's down there in its own. I believe for the most part these requirements are other than some rewording, putting it into the must should language, things like that are basically what we had in the three different documents. So Scott, did you want to say anything else?
No, I think you captured it very well.
So questions?
John?
So I noticed that pretty much everything is a must. And when I was reading that, were you guys struggling too with what should be what is a must and what should is a should here, considering the lack of requirements we have? That's something I'm just struggling with.
Yeah, I mean we did kind of cross that bridge. We do have one may in there, but yeah, we did. And you'll notice the SLA doesn't really have anything. But yeah, it was basically without someone telling us no, that's not a good idea, or well, that's nice, but, you know, don't get hung up on it. It was very difficult to say what was a must and what was a should.
Okay. So, I'm with the same thing. The SLA thing, the one I think should or probably a must, there we go again, on there is transparency of those SLAs. I think we could put something in there such saying that whatever the SLAs are, they should be published and transparent.
That's a good idea.
And yeah, this is great work, by the way.
Thank you.
Thanks, John. Scott?
Yeah, so to answer John's question from my perspective, I know as Andy and I were looking at this, you know, we were thinking about this in the context of what's required, which, you know, in my mind means that means what are the must. And so as we pulled together the bits, you know, Gavin, Andy, and I had pretty much identified things that we think are all required functionality. And the one that Andy and I debated a little bit, you know, was the one in three. I mean, I think we agreed to throw that out there as a may because it's not really something we had talked about as a group and reached any kind of consensus on whether or not it should be a must. But the reason you see so many musts here is because, you know, must and required are kind of synonymous.
Mm-hmm. Got it. Now, did you have a separate point to make also, Scott?
Nope.
Okay. Jody.
Thanks, Rahm. Can you guys hear me?
Yes.
Oh, okay. I'm not sure if this is supposed to go in here as a requirement, but it's one of the user stories or user cases that I've brought up before is the system, the ICANN RDAP proxy system, be passing to the CPH server RDAP systems. The reason of why non-public data needs to be returned and who is asking for it. But I don't see that in this list.
So I agree. I don't see it in the list either. Probably because it didn't show up on either of the three other documents. I do think I don't know. Maybe we should have a discussion about that. So Scott and I did talk briefly, and I don't know why it didn't even end up in here. We did talk briefly about providing about not necessarily giving the identity of who is requesting, but maybe giving a pseudo identity of who is requesting the data to the CPH servers. The reason we specified that is it's a good thing for the CPH servers to be able to say, hey, so and so has been really kind of abusing our system. But do they not actually necessarily even know that it's a specific law enforcement agent or whatever? That's really between ICANN and the identity providers. And there may be some confidentiality that goes on about who these people are. They may not want to, you know, for like law enforcement may not want it to be known that they're the ones doing the investigation. But certainly from a being able to audit the system, that does seem like a good idea for the CPH to have some sort of pseudo identity to be able to track who is doing what. As far as the reason, I guess that's not in there. I don't know what my only question about that would be, what would the CPH be doing with the reason?
This would be for auditing purposes. Basically, so the CPH has an idea of what's going on here. Giving up this data is a huge liability to us, and having the reasons as to why it's being given gives us a way to track this. I mean, we need to know this stuff. I'm also, you know, pseudomonizing it, whatever. I mean, if it's a, I'd still like to know what, you know, if it's LEA, it just needs to say LEA. You know, FBI or Europol or Interpol or whatever. It doesn't need to know the actual agent. I'm not looking for that detailed. I'm looking for the overarching, because I'm still expecting that the LEA would have some kind of portal on their side, and that we're not going to have 10,000 different LEA communities coming to our site to get this information.
Okay. What do others think?
All right. Scott's in line, and then Francisco, and then I put myself in the queue. Scott.
Hey, thanks, Ron. Scott Hollenbeck. Hey, Andy, if you remember the list that I had come up with, I had a feature there that said something about, you know, the system must be able to, you know, associate attributes with the identity, you know, in order to help make these authorization decisions or something like that. This kind of gets at what Jody's talking about. You know, without getting specific about what those attributes are, I mean, I think that's certainly something we as a group can talk about. But I think we could address Jody's comment and concern here by, you know, creating a new 2A that, you know, replicates the text I had in my suggestion about those attributes. And I could go dig those up again if it would be helpful.
No, that sounds good. I remember what you said, and I remember our discussions. We were going around about attributes and roles and what they mean. But no, we can go back through and dig that up.
Yeah, I mean, and for the benefit of the others, I think what Andy and I decided, if you look at what 2A currently says right now, you know, the system must be able to determine whether a requester is authorized, right? The existence of these kind of attributes go into that kind of decision. But we can be more explicit. And so let me go dig up that text. I'll paste it in the chat, and maybe we can add that to the document.
Thanks, Scott. Francisco.
Thank you, Rob. I think we have discussed this several times. I think Joran told us that he wanted this to be one of the requirements, meaning not to pass the datum, but I think Jody has raised this point multiple times, wanting the opposite. I was wondering, just thinking, the charter covers, says something like when there are multiple alternatives on the policies or the technical implementations, the group will strive to support options for which choices can be finalized later, meaning when the policy discussions happen and decide on what to do. So I was thinking, why not we have a requirement for the justification and the identity of the requester to be able to be passed to the contract party and leave it for the eventual policy to decide whether that will be passed or not. An idea.
So let me see if I understand what you're saying, Francisco. We make that a requirement, or we add it in the requirement, but the actual implementation of that may end up getting decided by the policymakers rather than by the technical folks. Is that what you mean?
Sort of. What I'm saying is that we make it an option in the spec. We define where the fields will go if they are were to be passed, and make a note there, or just leave it for the policy to decide later whether that would be passed or not. and a decision will be made in the policy side, not here on the technical side.
Okay, got it. Thanks, Francisco. I put myself in the queue. What I thought 2A should be modified to, I actually thought 2A as it exists or even Scott's language is fine. But I thought the piece that is missing, Scott, in the language you're proposing, your new language says the system must be able to associate attributes with an identity that can be used to determine an end user's level of authorization for every query. But I think we also need another thing that says the system may transmit such attributes downstream or something like that. So that covers the second piece, which I agree with Jody would be an important criterion for CPH. Murray?
Just a couple things. I'm a little puzzled about, it sounds like we're talking about levels of access now, where before we were just talking about you are or aren't authorized to access the private information. Is that the case, that there are different categories? I understand that there are different categories of requester, and it's important to note whether you, which sort of exception you fall into. But is that, does the answer to that, which category you're in, govern what you're going to get back, or is it simply that you're in one of the privileged categories, therefore you can get what you need?
Let's answer Murray's question first, Benedict, before we come to you. Because I'll come back to your second question, Murray.
Sure.
The way I look at your first question is that the decision on what happens after you're given access is not something that we worry about. That's driven by what happens in the policy side. But I don't know that we actually are looking to create multiple levels. I thought what we had agreed on was that there are roles and the roles define what happens. But that's my understanding. It would be good to have a discussion about that.
Maybe someone can give a description of two different levels of access and how they would be treated differently. My understanding was simply that you are in the system as someone ICANN will release information to. And it's important to know which profile you fit in, but do they get differential treatment in terms of what they have access to? And this goes back to 2A because do we need to carry a field with it as part of the request, or do you simply need to remember that the person got this information under the auspices of a particular category? That changes the protocol a little bit, and it probably changes handling a little bit.
Right. Let me ask folks to come out of the order in the queue. So, Francisco, perhaps you have an answer to that question or a thought on that. Are there any others who would like to have a thought on that? Raise your hand, and I'll put you in, and then I'll come back to you, Murray, for your second question, and then to you, Benedict.
Okay.
Francisco.
Thank you, Ram. So to respond quickly to Murray, I put also something in the chat. I think the having multiple profiles or levels of access is, of course, a policy decision, and what they will get access to, that's of course also a policy decision. What I'm trying to say is that the protocol should support that. It should assume there are multiple. If at the end that it happens that the policy decides that there is only one, and that gives you access to everything, that's fine, because that is a subset of the of having multiple profiles. So I would think that should be supported. That should not be a problem for the protocol support. To answer the other question you raised, Murray, I'll give you an example. For example, the registrars, they may, in the case of in the transfer case, they may not need access to the full data. Maybe they only need the email address of the registrant or the admin contact for both, and that's all they need. But law enforcement agent, they may need the full set of data And maybe the certificate authorities, maybe they need access to the name of the register, but nothing else. It really depends on the use cases that will be defined by the policy. Thank you.
Okay. All right. I see Andy, and then Crocker has a comment which I'll read out. Andy?
Yes. So I agree with what Francisco just said. And as far as like use cases, you know, I could see where people who run abuse desks for ISPs, they care about abuse email addresses, but they don't really need physical postal addresses or anything like that, whereas law enforcement probably wants both or the other or something like that. So I think there would be a policy reason for having multiple. I don't know. I don't think we should come up with them, but we should be able to support that. One of the things that I think we need to clarify is these attributes of the requester, which could get passed to the CPH, the purpose for that is not to do the authorization of what data they see. The purpose of that should be for tracking and auditing purposes. And the reason I say that is because the text that, which is now scrolled by, but the text that Scott put in actually said those attributes are for determining what data they get to see. And I think that responsibility should be up to ICANN, the ICANN's proxy server. That's all I have to say.
Okay. And Steve, I know that you're in a noisy place. Do you want to speak or do you want me to read out what you've written? If I don't hear from you, I'm just going to read out. Okay. Steve says, the discussions I've been in, there is a distinct possibility that a member of a particular group might be able to make requests with different access profiles. One specific example is LEA may have an ordinary query and also a query backed by a warrant. The latter will yield more data. So that comes back to what Francisco was suggesting, that the levels of access is we should simply assume there are multiple profiles, Murray, and design the protocol based on that.
Okay.
All right, back to you, Murray, for your second question.
Yes. So then my second question, we touched on it a little bit, is does the, pardon the terminology, CPH, something Cal Pacific Hospital is what keeps coming to my mind every time I hear that acronym. So I assume that that's a registrar or something like that.
CPH is a short form, Murray, for Contracted Parties House, which includes registries and registrars.
They're the ones that have the data.
They're the ones that have the data.
Okay. So I guess the last bit of this to put it all together in my head is, do they need to know the profile of the request? And I guess the answer is yes. But Jody mentioned they need to know it for liability reasons. And I'm wondering, does that need to be part of the request, or does ICANN simply need to have a record that they can go get later if legal action is launched or something like that? And I'm trying to rationalize this against pressure to not reveal, for example, in a law enforcement case, that this was a law enforcement query. So there's, it doesn't seem to me that there's a clear answer there about the, once you know the profile, does it have to be revealed what the profile was, or does there have to be capacity for the profile to be kept secret in some ways?
So, I have a thought on that, and then Jody has his hand up as well. From my perspective, I think it would be good for us to design it in such a way that there can be a pointer back to ICANN, rather than pass that down to CPH. But that's my own preference. Jody?
Thanks, Rob. To Murray's point, you know, that profile or what gets returned, my understanding for the CPH guys was that we were just returning all the data to ICANN, and then ICANN was using its profile to filter out the data elements that were not supposed to be used or supposed to be returned to the request. But that was my understanding of how we were approaching this. Basically, the profile was kept at ICANN, and then it controlled how much data was actually returned. But the registrars and the registries, the CPHs, would be returning just the complete dump of the data as what used to be done in the WHOIS before May 25th. I'm just curious on Gavin's thoughts or just thoughts on that. Thanks.
Thanks, Jody. Gavin, did you want to speak about that? If you're speaking, we cannot hear you.
Apologies, I missed that. Sorry.
Jody, did you want to repeat your question so that Gavin can listen to it and respond?
Sure, Peter, but I think Francisco
has
already...
After Gavin, I'm going to come to you, Scott.
I think Francisco has already answered the question, but basically what I was asking was, it was my understanding that EPHs would be returning the full contact data for anyone who requested the non-public data, that the CPHs would not be trying to filter what data is returned based on a profile. Basically, what's being returned on RDAP, according to the CPHs, is pretty binary. You either get public data or non-public data. And non-public data would include the public data, I guess. So maybe it's not binary, but that was my understanding. Thanks.
All right. Gavin, Scott, and then Francisco.
So this is Gavin. That was my belief as well, that the contracted party would send the full response back to ICANN, and ICANN would perform the filtering.
Scott?
I tend to agree. Other than, perhaps when we write this up in the end, we should note that it is possible that, the CPHs take on, the role and responsibility of dealing with the authorization question. And I say this not because it's necessarily something that I think I want to do as an operator or should do, but it gets back, to the question I had last week about, the memo that the EPDP got on, joint controllership versus, sole controllership and the unified access model. I mean, imagine if, the DPAs come back and say, nope, ICANN, this model doesn't fly. I would like whatever we produce to have enough information in it, such that there's at least some guidance there for people to consider model alternatives.
Thanks, Scott. Francisco?
Oh, I don't have my hand raised.
I know, I'm calling on you.
So what's the question?
I'm calling on you because you had written in the chat that in your perspective, the model is that ICANN gets the full data from TPH, and then ICANN filters out fields according to the user profile. So I thought you might want, if you want to, you can expand on that.
Oh, okay, yes. So I thought we have talked about this before. Yeah, the idea is to make things simpler and so the contract parties do not have to be burdened with knowing what the profile is. Also, that will support the case scenario if the policy decides that the contract parties should not know about the justification and the identity of the user, then you don't want to give them the another data point, which will be the profile of the user. So making things simpler, you leave up to ICANN to filter the fields that need to be filtered so that the user only gets what is allowed per their profile. Hope that makes sense.
Okay, thanks. Benedict, was your hand about this point or about the point you were originally going to make? Okay, thanks.
Sorry, Ron. The mobile, just so you guys know, the mobile Adobe Connect client handles hands remarkably badly. My hand's been up for about 10 minutes, but it disappears. It drops the client drops it whenever you switch contact. My point for Jody is just to say that I think there would be significant pushback from law enforcement if if any identifying information is passed to the registry or registrar, even whether a request was from Ellie or not. And I think for that, to solve that concern, I think ICANN would have to be a trusted intermediary with transparency and dealt with through retrospective audits and logging. Thanks.
Thanks, Benedict. Murray, your hand is up, then I'll go in after you.
No, I think that pretty much established my next question, is how do we resolve this tension between what Jody says he wants or needs for indemnification and what Benedict is saying law enforcement is going to want to keep from him.
Thanks, Murray. That's why I was suggesting earlier that perhaps the thing that ICANN ends up doing is it provides the CPH some sort of a record locator or some sort of a pointer, where ICANN still has the actual records, but from an audit, et cetera, point of view, the CPH potentially has that that pointer or that record locator that they can use to say, if they get audited or if they get requested for information, they can point to that and say, this is the reference, but if you want to find out the actual rationale, reason, identity, you will have to go to the single source, which is ICANN. Jody?
Hi. Just responding to Benedict's statement there about LEA. It's interesting that LEA would not want to have that, and we're kind of basing some decisions on whether ICANN is going to sign an indemnification clause here. And, you know, whether they do that or not, I'd still like the ability to be able to have that information passed to us.
Fair enough, and that's why in the friendly addition to 2A that I suggested adding a second part, which is the system may transmit such attributes to parties that store the non-public data, and that preserves the option, Jody. And we should see about language for this idea of having a pointer be sent from ICANN to the contracted parties, that it is maybe that it's not those attributes that are passed, but it may be a pointer to those attributes that are passed. And I'm sure Scott and Andy, you can take that and work with that. I'm also seeing Steve writing a couple of other things on the chat. So Steve says it's probably easier to design the system the way we're discussing. That is, ICANN gets the records, the full record, and then forwards only what's allowed. That's easier than trying to have registrars respond only with what's needed. However, a common failure mode for a system this way is that the filter fails and the requester gets more than he should. What do folks think about that failure mode? It's a single point of failure with ICANN, and if ICANN's system fails to filter, a non-public data will be made available to an unauthorized party. Andy?
That's an interesting point, but I believe failure there's failure in other aspects of the system that could lead to things that are otherwise not a good state, such as failure to properly authenticate someone or misauthenticating someone. So yes, it's an issue, as is failure in other parts of the system, but I don't think it would stop us from going with a model where ICANN is the filter.
Thanks, Jody.
Yeah, I agree with Andy. We have to have the point of failure somewhere, and this all rests, I hate to be a broken record here, on ICANN filling out that indemnification clause and putting that in writing. This will be on the responsibility of ICANN to ensure that profile is correct and that they don't have any information in there or any bugs in there that would release that data to someone who shouldn't have it. Thanks.
Okay, thanks. Benedict?
This is Gavin. Can I just have a comment on this?
Yes, please, Gavin.
Thank you. On the question of what happens if the ICANN filter fails, I think, it seems to me that ICANN has to be on the hook for any failures that occur within the perimeter of their system. But it occurs to me that building a fault tolerant design, there are a number of ways you could minimize the risk of that sort of thing happening. For example, we've been using the phrase filter, as in you take a bucket of JSON you've received from one of the contracted parties, and then you selectively remove things and then pass it back on to the requester. You could build a much more fault tolerant model where rather than doing that, you start with a brand new clean RDAP spot that contains nothing. And using data you receive from the contracted party, and so only stuff you proactively put into that response gets returned to the client. So if there's a failure in the filter, or perhaps the response from the contracted party contains other data elements that you weren't expecting or haven't built logic to remove, then they don't get passed back to the requester.
Thanks, Gavin. Benedict?
Hi there. So GDPR envisions this kind of failure and essentially says that you need to notify that the data subject, you can leave their data accidentally. Obviously, that would be attention to be resolved if that's in relation to a law enforcement request. It would have to have probably a manual review. But this is almost standard procedure stuff. It's released accidentally. GDPR says you tell the person, and then they can complain to the DPA if they want to. As long as you've told them you've done your part. This thing happens all the time. It doesn't automatically put anyone on the hook for fines or liability. There's a defined process for it in law.
Thanks, Benedict. Scott, you had an interesting comment in the chat. Wouldn't it be safer to fail in such a way that less info is returned? Do you want to speak a little bit more to that?
Oh yeah, sure, Ron. Thank you. Scott Hollenbeck here. I'm just thinking that since there is a risk of disclosing data that should not be disclosed, the default behavior here should be to assume that the requestor is unauthorized and thus, all that would be returned is some minimal set of public data. Anything that would warrant the return of more information, should be based on success criteria being met, proper client identification, prior authentication, prior authorization, and whatnot. So, I don't think we want to run into a situation where a failure resulted in the inadvertent disclosure of information that should not have been disclosed. So better to have defaults that just don't make that possible.
Yeah, I fully endorse that approach. What do others think? No one objecting. Okay. Any other comments on this spec? I see no other comments. What I'd like to do is, if Scott and Andy, if you can reflect on the conversations here today, some of the edits that have come across your way, and provide a new version out on the list, we can opine on it. And then if we can wrap that up, then what I'd like to do is take that and make that part of the record, if you will, publish that to the list so that people from outside who are curious and who are interested can go look at it as well. So if you can do that, that'll be a useful thing. And Andy said
sure.
That the two of you will reiterate on it. Okay, great. Thanks. The question on the the format of doing this, I don't know that we really need to talk about it much, right? There's a proposal to use the IETF format. There's no one who is objecting vehemently to it. Gavin has said, let's also make sure that we make it readable by lay people. We've already got agreement on that, and Scott has been voluntold to help write a preamble, for this document. And, it sounds like we have twisted the right arms here. Okay, that's settled. What else should we talk about on this call today? Andy?
On that last topic, I'm joking around here when I'm volunteering Scott, but I really don't want to preclude anyone else if they want to do any of the writing. So if someone else wants to volunteer, I think that would be great.
Well, look, if you want to volunteer, just get in touch with Scott and Andy directly. I don't think we need to do this in any moderated manner. Everybody on this list is going to have a chance to go review, modify, et cetera. But in general, with these things, the hardest lift is that first draft. And after that, everybody can come in and comment. So I appreciate both Andy and Scott putting their hand up. Dobofumi?
Yes. I had a quick question. I'm sorry to bring this up late, but I agree that in number one overall, it needs to be based on the current internet standards. But what I brought up at the last meeting, the face-to-face meeting, about potentially using certificates as an alternative, that one's actually currently an internet draft. It's not really, it doesn't have RFC number yet, but does this matter or is it going to be out of scope?
What do folks think?
Can you send that the draft to the mailing list so we could read it, because I don't know which one it was. Personally, I don't have an issue with going on of looking at it and using it, even if it's not an RFC. So I feel that we're going to be inventing a couple of things here or there anyway. So yeah, why not?
Thanks. Great.
Mrs. Ram, just to back to you, Tomofumi, did you not also in our face-to-face, I recall you saying that there are a couple of things that are also in quote-unquote BCP form, but not in the IETF, for example, NIST or other places. Did you not say something about that, especially on the crypto side?
I might have mentioned that. That's right. Some of the standards may not be necessarily in. Yeah.
In the IETF.
You say in. Right. It's not necessarily in the IETF. Yeah.
And this is Ram. I guess from the way I look at it, Andy and Scott, when I read internet standards, to me that translates to an RFC. But if you want to take a more expansive look at it or expansive view of it and say that this is not just RFCs but also, standards published by standards bodies or something like that, might be something that addresses Tomofumi's point from our face-to-face. What do you folks think?
Yeah, Ram, Scott here. I do too. I mean, but this is the reason why we didn't say, RFCs. I think we want to make sure that, current practices published by the CA browser forum, for example, W3C stuff is all in scope.
Right. Okay, good.
Oh, cool. Okay, cool.
I think that addresses your concern completely then, Tomofumi. This is not just IETF RFCs.
Yes, 100%. Thank you.
All right. Anything else to discuss on today's call, folks? Diana, Elisa, are there any administrative items you want to bring up to this group before we wrap the call up?
This is Elisa. I don't have any. Diana?
Hi, this is Diana. Just a quick question. Is there anybody that's not attending the face-to-face next week?
Next week?
The week after next, sorry.
Yes, I won't be there. This is Murray.
Murray won't be
okay.
There. But there was no configuration that was going to help Murray fit it in anyway.
Right. I just want to make sure everybody's booking their travel, and if they had any questions about COVID, reach out to me. Ron, do you want me to read out the action items I've taken or just
yes, please.
Okay, what I have is ICANN.org to prepare a presentation deck about what our group is doing. That's Elisa. And amendments to the requirements documentation. Part 2A, Scott and Andy will work on the text about identity attributes. And we'll also discuss and add language on the CPH receipt of record locator pointer topic. And then ICANN.org will publish the draft unified requirements document once that's completed. That's Diana. And then draft a preamble to the document, Scott and Andy. Did I miss anything?
If something is missed, please send it up on the list. One other thing, just to let you guys know that Elisa has helped draft a blog that will get published here shortly under my name that basically recounts what we did in our face-to-face and what the outputs are, et cetera. So that's coming, and we're hoping to get that published in the next few days. So it continues with this idea of just being open and transparent to the community on what we're doing. So that's on deck. All right, if there are no further items, let's wrap this call. Thank you all for your time. Appreciate the work that you guys are doing, and I look forward to seeing you online and on a call again next week. Thanks.
Take care, all.
Thank you. Bye.